and I wouldn't have let you do the vines, Shafa. It's because of me that...
She falters then, her throat closing with impending tears. Some of this is just nerves and exhaustion. Much of it, though, is the sense of guilt that has been lurking and growing within her for months, only now spilling out because she's too tired to keep it in. It's her fault that Shafa has lost everything. Found Moon, the children he cared for, the companionship of his fellow guardians, the reliable power that should have come from his core stone, even peaceful sleep at night. She's why he's down here in the dust of a dead city, and why they're about to entrust themselves to machinery older than Sansa, and maybe the whole stillness, to go to an impossible place and do an impossible thing. Shafa sees all this instantly with the skill of a long-time caretaker of children. The frown clears from his face, and he shakes his head and crouches to face her.
No, he says. Nothing is your fault, my Nasun. No matter what it has cost me, no matter what it may cost yet. Always remember that I...
His expression falters. For a fleeting instant, that horrible blurry confusion is there, threatening to wipe away even this moment in which he means to declare his strength to her. Nasun catches her breath and focuses on him in the silver, and bares her teeth as she sees that the core stone in him is alive again, working viciously along his nerves and spidering over his brain even now, trying to force him to heal.
No, she thinks in a sudden fury. She grips his shoulders and shakes him.
It takes her whole body to do this because he's such a big man, but it makes him blink and focus through the blur.
You're Shafa, she says. You are. And you chose.
Because that's important. That's the thing the world doesn't want people like them to do.
You're not my guardian anymore. You're...
She dares to say it aloud at last.
You're my new father, okay? And that means we're family. And we have to work together. That's what family does, right? You let me protect you sometimes.
Shafa stares at her. Then he sighs and leans forward to kiss her forehead. He stays there after the kiss, nose pressed into her hair. Nasun makes a mighty effort and does not burst into tears. When he speaks at last, the horrible blurriness has faded, as have even some of the pain lines around his eyes.
Very well, Nasun. Sometimes you may protect me.
That settled. She sniffs, wipes her nose on a sleeve, and then turns to face Steel. He hasn't changed position, so she pulls away from Shafa and goes over to him, stopping right in front of him. His eyes shift to follow her, lazily slow.
Don't do that again.
She half expects him to say in his too knowing voice,
Do what?
Instead, he says,
It's a mistake to bring him with us.
Cold washes through Nasun, followed by hot. Is it a threat or a warning? She doesn't like it either way. Her jaw feels so tight that she almost bites her tongue trying to speak.
I don't care.
Silence in reply. Is this capitulation? Agreement? Refusal to argue. Nasun doesn't know. She wants to yell at him, say you won't hurt Shafa again. Even though it feels wrong to yell at any adult. Yet she has also spent the past year and a half learning that adults are people. And sometimes they are wrong, and sometimes somebody should yell at them. But Nasun is tired. So instead she retreats to Shafa, taking his hand tightly and glaring back at Steel, daring him to say anything else. He doesn't, though. Good. The huge green thing sort of ripples then, and they all turn to face it. Something is... Nasun shudders, both revolted and fascinated. Something is growing from the weird nodules all over the thing's surface. Each is several feet long, narrow, feather-like, attenuating near the tips. In a moment, there are dozens of them, curling and waving gently in an unfelt breeze. Cilia, Nussin thinks suddenly, remembering a picture in an old biomestry creche book. Of course. Why wouldn't people who made buildings out of plants also make carriages that looked like germs? Some of the feathers are flickering faster than others, clustering together for a moment at a point along the thing's side. Then the feathers all peel back, flattening against the mother-of-pearl surface, to reveal a soft rectangle of a door. Beyond, Nossun can see gentle light and surprisingly comfortable-looking chairs in rows. They will ride in style to the other side of the world. Nossun looks up at Shafa. He nods back at her with jaw tight. She does not look at Steel, who hasn't moved and makes no attempt to join them. Then they climb aboard, and the feathers weave the door shut behind them. As they sit down, the great vehicle utters a low, resonant tone and begins to move. Wealth has no value when the ash falls. Tablet 3, Structures, Verse 10. Syl Anagist, 2. It's a magnificent house, compact, but elegantly designed and full of beautiful furnishings. We stare at its arches and bookcases and wooden banisters. There are only a few plants growing from the cellulose walls, so the air is dry and a little stale. It feels like a museum. We cluster together in the big room at the front of the house, afraid to move, afraid to touch anything. "Do you live here?" one of the others asks Kalenli. "Occasionally," she says. Her face is expressionless, but there is something in her voice that troubles me. "Follow me." She leads us through the house, a den of stunning comfort, every surface soft and suitable, even the floor. What strikes me is that nothing is white. The walls are green, and in some places painted a deep, rich burgundy. In the next room, the beds are covered in blue and gold fabric in contrasting textures. Nothing is hard and nothing is bare, and I have never thought before that the chamber I live in is a prison cell. But now, for the first time, I do. I have thought many new things this day, especially during our journey to this house. We walked the whole way, our feet aching with the unaccustomed use, and the whole way people stared. Some whispered. One reached out to stroke my hair in passing, then giggled when I belatedly twitched away. At one point a man followed us. He was older, with short gray hair almost the same texture as ours, and he began to say angry things. Some of the words I did not know. Knees spread and fork tongue, for example. Some I knew, but did not understand. Mistakes, and "we should have wiped you out," which makes no sense, because we were very carefully and intentionally made. He accused us of lying, though none of us spoke to him, and of only pretending to be gone somewhere. He said that his parents and his parents' parents taught him the true horror, the true enemy. Monsters like us were the enemy of all good people, and he was going to make sure we didn't hurt anyone else. Then he came closer, big fists balled up, as we stumbled along gawping, so confused that we did not even realize we were in danger. Some of our unobtrusive guards abruptly became more obtrusive and pulled the man into a building alcove where they held him while he shouted and struggled to get at us. Kalenli kept walking forward the whole time, her head high, not looking at the man. We followed,
knowing nothing else to do. And after a while the man fell behind us, his words lost to the sounds of the city. Later, Gaywa, shaking a little, asked Kalenli what was wrong with the angry man. Kalenli laughed softly and said, "He's Selenogistine." Gaywa subsided into confusion. We all sent her quick pulses of reassurance that we are equally mystified. The problem was not her. "This is normal life in Selenogist, we understand, as we walk through it. Normal people on the normal streets, normal touches that make us cringe or stiffen or back up quickly. Normal houses with normal furnishings, normal gazes that avert or frown or ogle. With every glimpse of normalcy, the city teaches us just how abnormal we are. I have never minded before that we were merely constructs, gem-engineered by master geomagists and developed in capsids of nutrient slush, decanted fully grown so that we would need no nurturing. I have been proud until now of what I am. I have been content. But now I see the way these normal people look at us, and my heart aches. I don't understand why. Perhaps all the walking has damaged me. Now Kalenli leads us through the fancy house. We pass through a doorway, however, and find an enormous sprawling garden behind the house. Down the steps and around the dirt path, there are flower beds everywhere, their fragrance summoning us closer. These aren't like the precisely cultivated, gen-engineered flower beds of the compound, with their color-coordinated winking flowers. What grows here is wild, and perhaps inferior, their stems haphazardly short or long, and their petals frequently less than perfect. And yet, I like them. The carpet of lichens that covers the path invites closer study, so we confer in rapid pulse waves as we crouch and try to understand why it feels so springy and pleasant beneath our feet. A pair of scissors dangling from a stake invites curiosity. I resist the urge to claim some of the pretty purple flowers for myself, though Gaywa tries the scissors and then clutches some flowers in her hand tightly, fiercely. We have never been allowed possessions of our own. I watch Kalenli surreptitiously, compulsively, while she watches us play. The strength of my interest confuses and frightens me a little, though I seem unable to resist it. We've always known that the conductors failed to make us emotionless, but we, well, I thought us above such intensity of feeling. That's what I get for being arrogant. Now here we are, lost in sensation and reaction. Gaywa huddles in a corner with the scissors, ready to defend her flowers to the death. Dashwa spins in circles, laughing deliriously. I'm not sure exactly at what. Bimnihwa has cornered one of our guards and is peppering him with questions about what we saw during the walk here. The guard has a hunted look and seems to be hoping for rescue. Salehwa and Remhwa are in an intense discussion as they crouch beside a little pool, trying to figure out whether the creatures moving in the water are fish or frogs. Their conversation is entirely auditory, no earth talk at all. And I, fool that I am, watch Kalenli. I want to understand what she means us to learn, either from that art thing at the museum or our afternoon garden idol. Her face and Sesapine reveal nothing. But that's all right. I also want to simply look at her face and bask in that deep, powerful, orogenic presence of hers. It's nonsensical, probably disturbing to her, though she ignores me, if so. I want her to look at me, I want to speak to her. I want to be her. I decide that what I'm feeling is love. Even if it isn't, the idea is novel enough to fascinate me. So I decide to follow where its impulses lead. After a time, Calenly rises and walks away from where we wander the garden. At the center of the garden is a small structure, like a tiny house but made of stone bricks, rather than the cellulose green strait of most buildings. One determined ivy grows over its nearer wall. When she opens the door of this house, I am the only one who notices. By the time she stepped inside, all the others have stopped whatever they were doing and stood to watch her, too. She pauses, amused, I think, by our sudden silence and anxiety. Then she sighs and jerks her head in a silent, "Come on." We scramble to follow her. Inside, we cram carefully in after Calenly. It's a tight fit. The little house has a wooden floor and some furnishings. It's nearly as bare as our cells back at the compound. But there are some important differences. Calenly sits down on one of the chairs, and we realize this is hers. Hers. It is her cell? No. There are peculiarities all around the space, things that offer intriguing hints as to Kalinley's personality and past. Books on a shelf in the corner mean that someone has taught her to read. A brush on the edge of the sink suggests that she does her own hair, impatiently, to judge by the amount of hair caught in its bristles. Maybe the big house is where she is supposed to be. And maybe she actually sleeps there sometimes. This little garden house, however, is her home.
I grew up with conductor Calotte, Calenly says softly.
We've sat down on the flora in chairs and bed around her, rapt for her wisdom.
Raised alongside him, the experiment to his control, just as I'm your control. He's ordinary, except for a drop of undesirable ancestry.
I blink my ice-white eyes and think of Galatz, and suddenly I understand many new things.
She smiles when my mouth drops open in an O. Her smile doesn't last long, however.
They, Galatz's parents, who I thought were my parents, didn't tell me at first what I was. I went to school, played games, did all the things a normal Selenagist teen girl does while growing up. But they didn't treat me the same. For a long time, I thought it was something I'd done.
Her gaze drifts away, weighty with old bitterness.
I wondered why I was so horrible, that even my parents couldn't seem to love me.
Remhwa crouches to rub a hand along the wooden slats of the floor. I don't know why he does anything. Salehwa is still outside since Kalinli's little house is too crammed for her tastes. She has gone to stare at a tiny, fast-moving bird that flits among the flowers. She listens through us, though, through the house's open door. We all need to hear what Kalinli says, with voice and vibration, and the steady, heavy weight of her gaze.
"Why did they deceive you?" Gewa asks.
"The experiment was to see if I could be human."
Calenly smiles to herself. She's sitting forward in her chair, elbows braced on her knees, looking at her hands.
"See if, raised among decent, natural folk, I might turn out at least decent, if not natural. And so my every achievement was counted a Selenagistine success, while my every failure, or display of poor behavior, was seen as proof of genetic degeneracy."
Gehwa and I look at each other. "Why would you be indecent?" she asks, utterly mystified. Calenly blinks out of her reverie and stares at us for a moment, and in that time we feel the gulf between us. She thinks of herself as one of us, which she is.
She thinks of herself as a person too, though. Those two concepts are incompatible. Evil death, she says softly, wonderingly, echoing our thoughts. You really don't know anything, do you? Our guards have taken up positions at the top of the stairs leading into the garden, nowhere in earshot. This space is as private as anything we have had today. It is almost surely bugged, but Calendly doesn't seem to care, and we don't either. She draws up her feet and wraps her arms around her knees, curiously vulnerable for someone whose presence within the strata is as deep and dense as a mountain. I reach up to touch her ankle, greatly daring, and she blinks and smiles at me, reaching down to cover my fingers with her hand. I will not understand my feelings for centuries afterward. The contact seems to strengthen Calendly. Her smile fades, and she says, "Then I'll tell you." Remwa is still studying her wooden floor. He rubs the grain of it with his fingers and manages to send along its dust molecules. "Should you?" I am chagrined, because it's something I should have considered. She shakes her head, smiling. "No, she shouldn't. But she does anyway, through the earth, so we will know it's true." "Remember what I have told you. The stillness in these days is three lands, not one. Their names, if this matters, are Mekar, Kahirar, and Silir. Sil Anagist started out as part of Kahirar. Then all of it, then all of Mekar too. All became Sil Anagist. Silir to the south was once a small and nothing land occupied by many small and nothing peoples. One of these groups was the Thnias. It was hard to say their name with the proper pronunciation, so Sil Anagistines called them Nias. The two words did not mean the same thing, but the latter is what caught on. The Sil Anagistines took their land. The Nias fought, but then responded like any living thing under threat, with diaspora, sending whatever was left of themselves flying forth to take root and perhaps survive where it could. The descendants of these Nias became part of every land, every people, blending in among the rest and adapting to local customs. They managed to keep hold of who they were, though, continuing to speak their own language, even as they grew fluent in other tongues. They maintained some of their old ways, too, like splitting their tongues with salt acid for reasons known only to them. And while they lost much of the distinctive look that came of isolation within their small land, many retained enough of it that to this day, ice-white eyes and ash-blow hair carry a certain stigma. Yes, you see now. But the thing that made the Nias truly different was their magic. Magic is everywhere in the world. Everyone sees it, feels it, flows with it. In Sil Anagist, magic is cultivated in every flowerbed and tree line and grapevine-draped wall. Each household or business must produce its share, which is then funneled away in gen-engineered vines and pumps to become the power source for a global civilization. It is illegal to kill in Sil Anagist because life is a valuable resource. The Nias did not believe this. Magic could not be owned, they insisted, any more than life could be. And thus, they wasted both by building, among other things, plutonic engines that did nothing. They were just pretty, or thought-provoking, or crafted for the sheer joy of crafting. And yet this art ran more efficiently and powerfully than anything the Sil Anagistine had ever managed. How did it begin? You must understand that fear is at the root of such things. Nias people looked different, behaved differently, were different. But every group is different from others. Differences alone are never enough to cause problems. Syl Anagist's assimilation of the world had been over for a century before I was ever made. All cities were Syl Anagist. All languages had become Syl Anagistine. But there are none so frightened or so strange in their fear as conquerors. They conjure phantoms endlessly, terrified that their victims will someday do back what was done to them. Even if in truth, their victims couldn't care less about such pettiness and have moved on. Conquerors live in dread of the day when they are shown to be not superior, but simply lucky. So when Nias magic proved more efficient than Cernagistine, even though the Nias did not use it as a weapon. This is what Calenly told us. Perhaps it began with whispers that white Nias irises gave them poor eyesight and perverse inclinations, and that split Nias tongues could not speak truth. That sort of sneering happens, cultural bullying. But things got worse. It became easy for scholars to build reputations and careers around the notion that Nias Sesapine were fundamentally different somehow. More sensitive, more active, less controlled, less civilized, and that this was the source of their magical peculiarity. This is what made them not the same kind of human as everyone else. Eventually, not as human as everyone else. Finally, not human at all. Once the Nias were gone, of course, it became clear that the fabled Nias Sesapine did not exist. Cylinogistine scholars and biomagisters had plenty of prisoners to study. But try as they might, no discernible variants from ordinary people could be found. This was intolerable, more than intolerable. After all, if the Nias were just ordinary human beings, then on what basis had military appropriations, pedagogical reinterpretation, and entire disciplines of study been formed? Even the grand dream itself, Geoarcanity, had grown out of the notion that Cylinogistine magistric theory, including its scornful dismissal of Nias efficiency as a fluke of physiology, was superior and infallible. If the Nias were merely human, the world built on their inhumanity would fall apart. So, they made us. We, the carefully engineered and denatured remnants of the Nias, have Sesapine far more complex than those of ordinary people. Calenly was made first, but she wasn't different enough. Remember, we must be not just tools, but myths. Thus, we later creations have been given exaggerated Nias features. Broad faces, small mouths, skin nearly devoid of color, hair that laughs at fine combs. And we're all so short. They've stripped our limbic systems of neurochemicals and our lives of experience and language and knowledge. And only now, when we've been made over in the image of their own fear, are they satisfied. They tell themselves that in us, they've captured the quintessence and power of who the Nias really were, and they congratulate themselves on having made their old enemies useful at last. But we are not the Nias. We aren't even the glorious symbols of intellectual achievement that I believed we were. Syl Anagist is built on delusions, and we are the product of lies. They have no idea what we really are. It's up to us, then, to determine our own fate and future. When Calenly's lesson is done, a few hours have passed. We sit at her feet, stunned, changed, and changing by her words. It's getting late. She gets up. I'm going to get us some food and blankets, she says. You'll stay here tonight. We'll visit the third and final component of your tuning mission tomorrow. We have never slept anywhere but ourselves. It's exciting. Kehwa sends little pulses of delight through the ambient, while Remwa is a steady buzz of pleasure. Dashwa and Bimnihwa spike now and again with anxiety. Will we be all right, doing this thing that human beings have done throughout history, sleeping in a different place? The two of them curl together for security, though this actually increases their anxiety for a time. We are not often allowed to touch. They stroke one another, though, and this gradually calms them both. Kalenli is amused by their fear. You'll be all right, though I suppose you'll figure that out for yourselves in the morning, she says. Then she heads for the door to go. I am standing at the door, looking through its window at the newly risen moon. She touches me because I'm in her way. I don't move at once, though. Because of the direction that the window in my cell faces, I don't get to see the moon often. I want to savor its beauty while I can. Why have you brought us here? I ask Kalenli, while still staring at it. Why tell us these things? She doesn't answer at once. I think she's looking at the moon, too. Then she says, in a thoughtful reverberation of the earth, I've studied what I could of the Nies and their culture. There isn't much left, and I have to sift the truth from all the lies. But there was a practice among them, a vocation. People whose job it was to see that the truth got told. I frown in confusion. So? What? You've decided to carry on the traditions of a dead people? Words. I'm stubborn. She shrugs. Why not? I shake my head. I'm tired and overwhelmed and perhaps a little angry. This day has upended my sense of self. I've spent my whole life knowing I was a tool. Yes, not a person, but at least a symbol of power and brilliance and pride. Now I know I'm really just a symbol of paranoia and greed and hate. It's a lot to deal with. Let the Nies go, I snap. They're dead. I don't see the sense in trying to remember them. I want her to get angry, but she merely shrugs. That's your choice to make, once you know enough to make an informed choice. Maybe I didn't want to be informed. I lean against the glass of the door, which is cool and does not sting my fingers. You wanted to be strong enough to hold the onyx. I blurt a soft laugh, too tired to remember I should pretend to feel nothing. Hopefully our observers won't notice. I shift to earth talk and speak in an acid, pressurized boil of bitterness and contempt and humiliation and heartbreak. What does it matter, is what it means. Geoarcanity is a lie. She shakes apart my self-pity with gentle, inexorable slip-strike laughter. Ah, my thinker. I didn't expect melodrama from you. What is mellow? I shake my head and fall silent, tired of not knowing things. Yes, I'm sulking. Kalenli sighs and touches my shoulder. I flinch, unused to the warmth of another person's hand. But she keeps it in place, and this quiets me. Think, she repeats. Does the plutonic engine work? Do your Sisapine? You aren't what they made you to be. Does that negate what you are? That question doesn't make sense. But now I'm just being stubborn. I understand her point. I'm not what they made me. I'm something different. I'm powerful in ways they did not expect. They made me, but they do not control me, not fully. This is why I have emotions, though they tried to take them away. This is why we have Earth Talk, and perhaps other gifts that our conductors don't know about. She pats my shoulder, pleased that I seem to be working through what she's told me. A spot on the floor of her house calls to me. I will sleep so well tonight, but I fight my exhaustion and remain focused on her, because I need her more than sleep for now. You see yourself as one of these truth-tellers? I ask. Lorist. The last Nies Lorist. If I have the right to claim such a thing. Her smile abruptly fades, and for the first time, I realize what a wealth of weariness and hard lines and sorrow her smiles cover. Lorists were warriors, storytellers, nobility. They told their truths in books and song and through their art engines. I just talk. But I feel like I've earned the right to claim some part of their mantle. Not all fighters use knives, after all. In Earth Talk, there can be nothing but truth, and sometimes more truth than one wants to convey. I sense something in her sorrow. Grim endurance. A flutter of fear like the lick of salt acid. Determination to protect something. It's gone. A fading vibration before I can identify more. She takes a deep breath and smiles again. So few of them are real, her smiles. To master the onyx, she continues, you need to understand the Nies. What the conductors don't realize is that it responds best to a certain emotional resonance. Everything I'm telling you should help. Then, finally, she pushes me gently aside so that she can go. The question must be asked now. So what happened, I say slowly, to the Nies? She stops and chuckles, and for once it is genuine. You will find out tomorrow, she says. We're going to see them. I'm confused. To their graves? Life is sacred in Sil-Anagist, she says over her shoulder. She's passed through the door. Now she keeps going without stopping or turning back. Don't you know that? And then she is gone. It is an answer that I feel I should understand. But in my own way, I am still innocent. Kalenli is kind. She lets me keep that innocence for the rest of the night. 2. Alma Innovator Dibars. From Yater Innovator Dibars. Alma, the committee can't pull my funding. Look, this is just the dates of the incidents I've gathered. Just look at the last 10. 2729, 2714 through 2719, choking. 2699, 2613, 2583, 2562, 2530, 2501, 2490, 2470, 2400, 2322 through 2329, acid. Is Seventh even interested in the fact that our popular conception of the frequency of season-level events is completely wrong? These things aren't happening every 200 or 300 years. It's more like every 30 or 40. If not for Ragas, we'd be 1,000 times dead. And with these dates and the others I've compiled, I'm trying to put together a predictive model for the more intensive seasons. There's a cycle here, a rhythm. Don't we need to know in advance if the next season is going to be longer or worse somehow? How can we prepare for the future if we won't acknowledge the past? 9. The desert, briefly, and you. Deserts are worse than most places during seasons. Tonki lets Yika know that water will be easy. Kastrina's innovators have already assembled a number of contraptions they're calling dew catchers.
The sun won't be an issue either, thanks to the ash clouds that you never thought you'd have cause to thank. It will be chilly, in fact, though less so by day. You might even get a bit of snow. No, the danger of deserts during a season is simply that nearly all animals and insects there hibernate, deep under the sand where it's still warm. There are those who claim to have figured out a surefire method of digging up sleeping lizards and such, but those are usually scams. The few calms that edge the desert guard such secrets jealously. The surface plants will have already shriveled away or been eaten by creatures preparing for hibernation, leaving nothing above ground but sand and ash. Stone Lore's advice on entering deserts during seasons is simply, don't. Unless you mean to starve. The calm spends 2 days camped at the edge of the Murs, preparing, though the truth is, as Yika has confided in you while you sat with her sharing your last mellow, there's really no amount of preparation that will make the journey any easier. People are going to die. You won't be one of them. It's a curious feeling knowing that Hoa can whisk you away to Core Point if there's any real danger. It's cheating, maybe. Except it's not. Except you're going to help as much as you can. And because you won't die, you're going to watch a lot of other people suffer. That's the least you can do, now that you've committed to the cause of Kostrima. Bear witness and fight like earth fires to keep death from claiming more than its share. In the meantime, the folks on cook fire duty pull double shifts roasting insects, drying tubers, baking the last of the grain stores into cakes, salting meat. After they were fed enough to have some strength, Mashish's surviving people turned out to be especially helpful with foraging, since several are locals and remember where there might be abandoned farms or debris from the rifting shake that hasn't been too picked over. Speed will be of the essence. Survival means winning the race between the Murs' with and Kostrima's supplies. Because of this, Tonki, who is increasingly becoming a spokesperson for the innovators, much to her own disgruntlement, oversees a quick and dirty breakdown and rebuilding of the storage wagons to a new, lighter, more shock-resistant design that should pull more easily over desert sand. The resistance and breeders redistribute the remaining supplies to make sure the loss of any one wagon, if it must be abandoned, won't cause some kind of critical shortage. The night before the desert, you're hunkered down beside one of the cook fires, still awkwardly navigating how to feed yourself with one arm, when someone sits down beside you. It startles you a little, and you jerk enough to knock your cornbread off the plate. The hand that reaches into your view to retrieve it is broad and bronze and nicked with combat scars, and there's a bit of yellow watered silk, filthy and ragged now, but still recognizable as such, looped around the wrist. Danil. Thanks, you say, hoping she won't use the opportunity to strike up a conversation. They say you were Fulcrum once, she says, handing the cornbread back to you. No such luck, then. It really shouldn't surprise you that the people of Kostrima have been gossiping. You decide not to care, using the cornbread to sop up another mouthful of stew. It's especially good today, thickened with corn flour and rich with the tender, salty meat that's been plentiful since the Stone Forest. Everybody needs as much fat on them as they can pack away, to prepare for the desert. You don't think about the meat. I was, you say, in what you hope sounds like a tone of warning. How many rings? You grimace in distaste, consider trying to explain the unofficial rings that Alabaster gave you. Consider how far you've come beyond even those. Consider being humble. And then finally you settle for accuracy. 10. Essun Tenring, the Fulcrum would call you now, if the seniors would bother to acknowledge your current name, and if the Fulcrum still existed, for what it's worth. Daniel whistles appreciatively. So strange to encounter someone who knows and cares about such things. They say, she continues, that you can do things with the obelisks. That's how you beat us at Kostrima. I had no idea you'd be able to rile up the bugs that way, or trap so many of the Stone Eaters. You pretend not to care, and concentrate on the cornbread. It's just a little sweet. The cookfire squad is trying to use up the sugar to make room for edibles with more nutritional value. It's delicious. They say, Daniel continues watching you sidelong, that a 10-ring raga broke the world up in the equatorials. Okay, no. Origin. What? Origin? It's petty, maybe. Because of Yika's insistence on making raga a use caste name, all the stills are tossing the word around like it doesn't mean anything. It's not petty. It means something. Not raga. You don't get to say, Raga, you haven't earned that. Silence for a few breaths. All right, Daniel says then, with no hint of either apology or humoring you. She just accepts the new rule. She also doesn't insinuate again that you're the person who caused the rifting. Point stands, though. You can do things most origins can't, yeah? Yeah. You blow a stray ash flake off the baked potato. They say, Daniel says, planting her hands on her knees and leaning forward, that you know how to end this season. That you're going to be leaving soon to go somewhere and actually try. And that you'll need people to go with you when you do. What? You frown at your potato. Are you volunteering? Maybe. You stare at her. You just got accepted into the strongbacks. Daniel regards you for a moment longer, expression unreadably still. You don't realize she's wavering, trying to decide whether to reveal something about herself to you, until she sighs and does it. I'm Lorist caste, actually. Daniel Lorist Renonis once. Daniel Strongback Kostrima's never gonna sound right. You must look skeptical as you try to visualize her with black lips. She rolls her eyes and looks away. Renanis didn't need lorists, the headman said. It needed soldiers. And everybody knows lorists are good in a fight. So, what? She sighs. Equatorial lorists, I mean. Those of us who come out of the old lorist families train in hand-to-hand, the arts of war and so forth. It makes us more useful during seasons and in the task of defending knowledge. You had no idea, but defending knowledge? A muscle flexes in Daniel's jaw. Soldiers might get a con through a season, but storytellers are what kept Sansa going through 7 of them. Oh. Right. She makes a palpable effort to not shake her head at mid-ladder provincialism. Anyway, better to be a general than cannon fodder, since that was the only choice I was given. But I've tried not to forget who I really am. Abruptly, her expression grows troubled. You know, I can't remember the exact wording of Tablet 3 anymore, or the tale of Emperor Mushtati. Just 2 years without stories, and I'm losing them. Never thought it would happen so fast. You're not sure what to say to that. She looks so grim that you almost want to reassure her. Oh, it'll be all right now that you're no longer occupying your mind with the wholesale slaughter of the Summit Lats or something like that. You don't think you could pull that off without sounding a little snide, though. Daniel's jaw tightens in a determined sort of way anyway, and she looks sharply at you. I know when I see new stories being written, though. I don't know anything about that. She shrugs. The hero of the story never does. Hero, You laugh a little, and it's got an edge. Can't help thinking of Alia and Tarimo and Mayov and Renonis and Kastrima. Heroes don't summon swarms of nightmare bugs to eat their enemies. Heroes aren't monsters to their daughters. I won't forget what I am, Danil continues. She's braced one hand on her knee and is leaning forward, insistent. Somewhere in the last few days, she's gotten her hands on a knife and used it to shave the sides of her scalp. It gives her a naturally lean, hungry look. If I'm possibly the last Equatorial Loris left, then it's my duty to go with you, to write the tale of what happens, and if I survive, to make sure the world hears it. This is ridiculous. You stare at her. You don't even know where we're going. Figured we'd settle the issue of whether I'm going first, but we can skip to the details if you want. I don't trust you, you say, mostly in exasperation. I don't trust you either, but we don't have to like each other to work together. Her own plate is empty. She picks it up and waves to one of the kids on cleanup duty to come take it. It's not like I have a reason to kill you, anyway. This time. And it's worse that Danil has said this, that she remembers sicking a shirtless guardian on you and is unapologetic about it. Yes, it was war, and yes, you later slaughtered her army, but people like you don't need a reason. I don't think you have any real idea who or what people like me are. She's not angry. Her statement was matter of fact. But if you need more reasons, here's another. Renonis is shit. Sure, there's food, water, and shelter. Your headwoman's right to lead you there if it's true that the city is empty now. Better than calmlessness, or rebuilding somewhere where there's no store caches. But shit, otherwise. I'd rather stay on the move. Bullshit, you say, frowning. No calm is that bad. Danil just lets out a single bitter snort. It makes you uneasy. Just think about it, she says finally, and gets up to leave. I agree that Danil should come with us, Lerna says, later that night when you tell him about the conversation. She's a good fighter, knows the road, and she's right. She has no reason to betray us. You're half asleep because of the sex. It's an anticlimactic thing now that it's finally happened. What you feel for Lerna will never be intense or guilt-free. You'll always feel too old for him. But well, he asked you to show him the truncated breast, and you did, thinking that would mark the end of his interest in you. The sandy patch is crusty and rough amid the smoother brown of your torso, like a scab, though the wrong color and texture. His hands were gentle as he examined the spot and pronounced it sound enough to need no further bandaging. You told him that it didn't hurt. You didn't say that you were afraid you couldn't feel anything anymore, that you were changing, hardening in more ways than one, becoming nothing but the weapon everyone keeps trying to make of you. You didn't say, maybe you're better off with unrequited love. But even though you didn't say any of these things, after the examination, he looked at you and replied, you're still beautiful. You apparently needed to hear that a lot more than you realized. And now here you are. So you process his words slowly, because he's made you feel relaxed and boneless and human again. And it's a good 10 seconds before you blurt, us? He just looks at you. Shit, you say, and drape an arm over your eyes. The next day, Kastrima enters the desert. There comes a time of greater hardship for you. All seasons are hardship. Death is the fifth and master of all. But this time is different. This is personal. This is 1,000 people trying to cross a desert that is deadly even when acid rain isn't sheeting from the sky. This is a group force-marched along a high road that is shaky and full of holes big enough to drop a house through. High roads are built to withstand shakes, but there's a limit, and the rifting definitely surpassed it. Yika decided to take the risk, because even a damaged high road is faster to travel than the desert sand. But this takes a toll. Every origin in the calm has to stay on alert, because anything worse than a micro-shake while you're up here could spell disaster. One day, Penty, too exhausted to pay attention to her own instincts, steps on a patch of cracked asphalt that's completely unstable. One of the other Raga kids snatches her away just as a big piece simply falls through the substructure of the road. Others are less careful and less lucky. The acid rain was unexpected. Stone Lore does not discuss the ways in which seasons can impact weather, because such things are unpredictable at the best of times. What happens here is not entirely surprising, however. Northward at the equator, the rifting pumps heat and particulates into the air. Moisture-laden tropical winds coming off the sea hit this cloud-seeding, energy-infusing wall, which whips them into a storm. You remember being worried about snow. No, it's endless, miserable rain. The rain is not so very acid as these things go. In the season of turning soil, long before Sansa, you would not know of it, there was rain that stripped animals' fur and peeled the skins off oranges. This was nothing compared to that, and diluted as it is by water, like vinegar, you'll live. Yika sets a brutal pace while you're on the high road. On the first day, everyone makes camp well after nightfall, and Lerna does not come to the tent after you wearily put it up. He's busy tending half a dozen people who are going lame from slips or twisted ankles, and two elders who are having breathing problems, and the pregnant woman. The latter three are doing all right, he tells you when he finally crawls into your bedroll near dawn. Ontrug the potter lives on spite, and the pregnant woman has both her household and half the breeders taking care of her. What's troubling are the injuries. I have to tell Yika, he says as you push a slab of rain-soaked cash bread and sour sausage into his mouth, then cover him up and make him lie still. He chews and swallows almost without noticing. We can't keep going at this pace. We'll start losing people if we don't... She knows, you tell him. You've spoken as gently as you can, but it still silences him. He stares until you lie back down beside him, awkwardly, with only one arm, but successfully. Eventually, exhaustion overwhelms anguish, and he sleeps. You walk with Yika one day. She's setting the pace like a good calm leader should, pushing no one harder than herself. At the lone midday rest stop, she takes off one boot, and you see that her feet are streaked with blood from blisters. You look at her, frowning, and it's eloquent enough that she sighs. Never got around to requisitioning better boots, she says. These are too loose. Always figured I'd have more time. If your feet rot off, you begin. But she rolls her eyes and points toward the supply pile in the middle of the camp. You glance at it in confusion, start to resume your scolding, and then pause. Think. Look at the supply pile again. If every wagon carries a crate of the salted cash bread and another of sausage, and if those casks are pickled vegetables, and those are the grains and beans... The pile is so small, so little for 1,000 people who have weeks yet to go through the Murs. You shut up about the boots, though she gets some extra socks from someone. That helps. It shocks you that you're doing as well as you are. You're not healthy, not exactly. Your menstrual cycle has stopped, and it's probably not menopause yet. When you undress to basin wash, which is sort of pointless in the constant rain, but habit is habit, you notice that your ribs show starkly beneath loose skin. That's only partly because of all the walking, though. Some of it is because you keep forgetting to eat. You feel tired at the end of the day, but it's a distant detachment.